What bad habits do you have or have you broken? We will talk about how we develop bad habits and how we can defeat them with a guest psychiatrist who says mindfulness techniques can help. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8.5 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Tuesday, July 19th. So we hope you will share with us the bad habits that you have of any kind, and we'll see what we can do to break them. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Dr. Judson Brewer, the Director of Research at the Center for Mindfulness and an Associate Professor in the Medicine and Psychiatry Department at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He is a psychiatrist and addiction expert who researches mindfulness techniques that effectively help put an end to cravings of all kinds. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, as a psychiatrist, what inspired you to study the connection between mindfulness and addiction?
Honestly, I was suffering just before I started medical school myself and was trying to find some way to get some relief.
Yeah, well, what were you suffering from, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, my suffering relative in the world seems pretty petty, but I'd gone through a pretty bad relationship breakup in the mid-90s right before starting medical school and was having trouble sleeping and was pretty stressed out.
Yeah, so you developed addictions or bad habits because of this?
Well, I think I had some bad habits, and some of them even related to getting caught up in my own storyline of, you know, woe is me. And as I started looking at that more and more later in my career, I started seeing all of these types of, you know, bad habits that fall along this addiction spectrum, not only in my life, but in the patients that I'd worked with.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should step back a bit and just kind of talk a bit about bad habits. I guess, what is the definition of a bad habit?
That's a good question. I think of, you know, habit formation along a continuum, and habits can be very helpful. You know, if we had to relearn how to get out of bed in the morning, to walk, to put on our clothes, to tie our shoes, to eat breakfast, we'd be exhausted by 10 a.m. So I think there's a spectrum where we can learn things that become somewhat habitual, such as tying our shoes, that are certainly helpful for us to survive. But when we look at habits that get in the way of our daily functioning and lead to stress or distress, that's where they start to fall into the continuum of bad habits.
And is there a difference between a bad habit and an addiction?
I think it's probably mostly just definitional. So a simple definition of addiction is continued use despite adverse consequences. So, it may even just be what's socially acceptable. There are people that text while driving. That could fall into a very bad habit range, or that could also fall into an addictive range if it causes an accident, for example.
Sure, and I guess a lot of times when we hear addiction, we think, oh, someone's addicted to a substance. But you can be addicted to a certain extent to biting your fingernails.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So how do bad habits form?
Well, if we look at how our brains work, I think that's a good place to start. And it may be traced all the way back to an evolutionarily conserved mechanism that helps us remember where food is. So if you think of, you know, back before food was plentiful, if we, you know, if our ancestors happened upon a nutritional food source such as berries or something like that, and they ate the berries, and that would send a signal from their stomach processing into their brain, basically, where they would get this dopamine spritz that says, oh, this tastes good. Remember where you found it. So in its simplest form, you can break it down into trigger, behavior, reward. So the trigger is seeing, you know, that food source again. The behavior is eating it, and then the reward is continued dopamine release where it says, oh, this is a good idea. And this can become habitual to the point where we anticipate, we get this dopamine rush when we just see the food and we anticipate that we're about to eat it. So it may go all the way back to a very evolutionarily conserved process. If you even look at it in the sea slug, you know, which only has 20,000 neurons, sea slugs form the same type of associative memory through positive and negative reinforcement as humans.
Comparing ourselves to sea slugs, but no, I get it. I'll be the first to admit, and maybe I can get some callers to also admit some bad habits. I have more than one bad habit, but when you were mentioning food, I think I do have a bad habit when it comes to food, where the stress eating, where you are, you know, oh, gee, it's really stressful, and I'm, you know, I'm under a lot of stress, or I'm not feeling very, you know, I'm feeling sad, so I'm going to have a cookie.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're saying is that stress kind of makes me think back to, oh, what made me feel good in the past when I was stressful or sad, and that cookie made me feel good, so therefore I'll eat that cookie.
Right, and this is where it gets really interesting, because this process gets hijacked by our emotional life. You know, so for example, it wasn't probably an evolutionarily conserved mechanism to eat when we were sad.
Right.
Or eat when we were stressed out. It was basically get those calories in so you'll survive. But now we've got that same mechanism in place. And like you're saying, you know, we learn to associate eating a cookie with feeling good even when we're not hungry.
Yeah, and then sometimes I will eat that cookie and say, why did I eat that cookie? I'm not even sad, I'm not stressed, and I didn't really want that cookie, and I'm trying to avoid that cookie.
Yes, have it.
the same goes for the big container of little mini chocolate bars that we have in our producer's room. You know, it's sort of like, I don't really need that little Snickers bar, but out of habit, I'll just grab one while we're having our meeting. And
yes.
So what's going on there?
Well, it's the same process, yet if you think of that trigger behavior reward, if the trigger becomes stress or, you know, feeling down or something like that, our brain, you know, might come in and say, oh, you know, I know what to do. Why don't you eat a cookie? And then we learn to associate those. So that becomes linked in a way that becomes so habitual that we don't even notice it. We're, you know, we're mindlessly reaching into the cookie jar without even paying attention.
All right. So we have all hour, but I need to know. It's a cookie jar or the candy bar jar. I'm going to walk into the producer's booth or the producer's office after the show.
Mm-hmm.
And what should I do to not just mindlessly grab a candy bar?
Well, I think you've already pointed to one place to start, which is to notice that you're on autopilot, that you're kind of robotically reaching toward that cookie jar. And you can even just get really curious about, oh, I'm noticing that my, you know, my brain is on autopilot. And just in that noticing, it kind of, it can break that spell. I don't know if you remember Pepe Le Pew from the cartoons. So he would kind of float along the air following the scent of the cat. And it's kind of, you know, we have those Pepe Le Pew moments where we're just sucked along. But then if we wake up and we can just snap out of it and realize, you know, kind of shake it off. And in that sense, you can think of habits, you know, like daydreaming, for example, where if we can wake up in that moment and it's just a habit, we can kind of break it. But if it's along the spectrum, you can think of stress, for example, being a little hard to snap out of. If only it were that easy where we could say, hey, you're stressed, snap out of it, and then we weren't stressed anymore. So that can be where we get sucked along a little bit further, and then I guess on the far end of the spectrum is this continued use despite adverse consequences, where we're texting when we're driving and we know that it's bad for us and we just can't stop, or we're eating that fourth and fifth cookie and just feeling completely out of control.
Yeah, and I will, in my own defense, I have my breakfast at about 3 a.m. in the morning, and then I prepare the show, and we do the show, goes on until 9 o'clock, and then by 9:15, it's time for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am grabbing that candy bar when I probably should be grabbing an apple.
Yeah, so the next piece here, so let's say that we're sucked along like Pepe Le Pew, the next piece could be, you know, as we're eating that food, we could pay attention and really just see what we're getting when we're eating it. And it's really interesting to see the difference when we really pay attention to the food that we eat. You know, I've heard stories of people eating, the gummy worms and just really paying attention, and they look at it and they're like, this is petroleum? You know, why am I eating this? And I run a mindful eating group, and last night somebody was describing completely becoming disenchanted with eating Cheetos because he realized this was popped, you know,
chemicals.
Orange. Yes. And he said, I have no problem not eating Cheetos anymore because I just woke up to the fact to what I was eating. And my body said, you know, this really isn't that good.
We're going to check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then we will continue talking with our guest, Dr. Judson Brewer, Director of Research at the Center for Mindfulness and an Associate Professor in Medicine and Psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, talking about bad habits and breaking bad habits. Do you have one? Have you successfully defeated one? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. When we come back, we'll talk about other bad habits and how we might defeat them. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about bad habits and how to defeat them and how we might transform bad habits into good ones. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is Dr. Judson Brewer, Director of Research at the Center for Mindfulness and an Associate Professor of Medicine and Psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He is a psychiatrist and addiction expert who researches mindfulness techniques that can help us put an end to our bad habits. We're welcoming your questions for him. We're welcoming your examples of bad habits that you have that maybe you'd like some help in breaking, or maybe you have defeated your own bad habits and or habit and you would like to share that, your technique. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So, Dr. Brewer, how long does it take for a bad habit to develop?
You know, that's a great question. I don't think there's a good answer to that. For some people, these can happen pretty quickly depending on the size of the reward in the situation. So, for example, if somebody is, you know, has a very stressful situation or something traumatic happen, and that probably opens up a window for them to be vulnerable to a habit happening. So, for example, I worked with a woman who started smoking when she was 12 or 13 after having some traumatic events happen, and it really got locked in pretty quickly. For others, it can just happen more insidiously where they, you know, oh, you have a little bit of, you know, have a drink after dinner and then, you know, eventually that builds and builds and builds and they don't even realize that they're drinking an entire, you know, bottle of wine a night.
Yeah. So how come one person can have that one glass of wine at dinner and that's fine and somebody else starts drinking a gallon after a while?
Yeah, there are many factors that go into that, and namely genetics can play a huge role here. Social factors can play a role. How somebody is raised, you know, in their environment can play a role. So there can be a lot of things that contribute to this, where, you know, many, many people have no problem having a glass of wine with dinner, and many people can't have a glass of wine with dinner.
Well, I'm going to fess up again, and some of my listeners know this. I also was a smoker. I started smoking when I was about 12 or 13 years old. I think that's when a lot of kids are experimenting, and back then, it was known that it wasn't good for you, but it wasn't quite as we didn't know that it was as dangerous as it is today. But I, with the help of another pharmaceutical, eventually, and it took a lifetime, I ended up quitting.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think I ended up doing some of that mindless eating after quitting. So there's a lot to this.
There is, and if you think of smoking, for example, it often gets laid down, like you're saying, in our early teenage years, and then gets, you know, as our prefrontal cortex gets pruned later in adolescence, it really gets locked in. Smoking is interesting because it can be, you know, we've had a lot of people come to our clinic and come to our programs who've had, you know, they've quit using pharmaceuticals, but then have gone back to smoking because the psychological cravings aren't targeted as much with these medications. Now, it's interesting. Here, we've done clinical studies where we basically have people go ahead and smoke. That's the first thing that we have them do, and just to pay attention to their smoking as they smoke. And you probably noticed this as you really started starting to kick the habit. It's amazing how much people don't realize how smoking doesn't actually taste very good. And when they wake up to that, and sometimes this can happen pretty quickly, you know, we had one patient say, you know, it smells like stinky teas and tastes like chemicals. And she said, yuck. So she starts, back to the Pepe Le Pew phenomenon, she started to wake up from that spell immediately with that first moment that she started paying attention. And so that's one aspect of it. Another aspect of it, especially the data have shown that, in particular for women, there's a big fear of quitting smoking because they're going to gain weight.
Yes.
And we now understand what that process may be or what may contribute to that, which is that we start to substitute eating for smoking. So there, you know, it can be contributed to by the oral fixation, by the dopamine release of eating sugar or candy, and then that habit gets substituted for smoking. So, of course, many people are going to gain weight. One thing that we've noticed when we were testing out an app-based version of our smoking cessation program was that people were reporting that they were actually changing their eating habits, and that's what actually got me interested in looking back at stress eating and the shared mechanisms there between that and other addictions.
Well, I can pretty much be a case study for your next project. But, let me ask a little bit about it. And I know I don't want to go too much into the science of addiction to nicotine, but isn't nicotine a tremendously addictive substance? It's more than just I'm going to think twice before I bite my fingernail.
Yes, nicotine's interesting. So if you think of the drug, the route of delivery, the number of times a day, there are many factors that contribute to nicotine being, and cigarettes in particular, being extremely addictive. So our lungs have capillary beds, the small blood vessels in our lungs. If you lay them out next to each other, they're the size of basically like a tennis court or a football field. There's this huge surface area. So if you smoke anything, that's going to be a route of delivery into your bloodstream that increases your blood levels really, really rapidly. And with that increase, with the rapidity of rise of chemical in our blood, that's proportional to the release of dopamine in our brain. So we're going to get this huge dopamine hit when we smoke cigarettes, and same thing is true with crack cocaine as compared to snorted cocaine. So we can start to see how nicotine in itself, with that route of delivery, it can be tremendously addictive. Now you combine that with the somewhat social acceptability of cigarettes. You can smoke 20 times a day, for example, if you smoke a pack of cigarettes. You can do this without, you know, too many social consequences, where you can't do this with alcohol or cocaine or heroin. So there's the availability of being able to do this routine over and over and over throughout the day that contributes as well.
Yeah. So how does your app or your mindfulness techniques overcome such a powerful addictive substance?
Well, as I mentioned, the first thing we do is we have them practice a mindful smoking exercise, and anybody can do this, you know, with or without the app. But basically, it walks them through how to really just pay attention as they're smoking. So noticing the urge, noticing what it feels like to pull the cigarette out of the pack, to smell the cigarette, to light it up, to breathe, to inhale the smoke, what that actually tastes like, what it feels like in their lungs, and to just really pay attention as they go through the process of smoking. Because many smokers that I see out on their smoke breaks, they've got a cigarette in one hand and they've got their phone in another. So they're out there, you know, distracting themselves already as they're mindlessly smoking. So that's the first step, which starts to build this disenchantment as they start to see very clearly what they're actually getting from smoking. And then the next step is to give them techniques that they can use, and that's the nice thing about a phone is they can have these right at their fingertips anytime they have an urge to smoke, and we can teach them what are now evidence-based techniques. One of our informal practices is called RAIN, where we can walk them through how to recognize what the craving feels like. That's the R. The A is allow it to be there. So typically, we want cravings to go away as quickly as possible, so we do whatever we can. Paradoxically, we turn toward it rather than pushing it away. That's the allowing it. And then the I is investigate. So get really curious about what a craving feels like. And we can actually flip the valence from unpleasant craving to curiosity, which is typically felt as pleasant. And in that curious moment, we can just notice what those body sensations are that make up a craving. If it's tightness or tension or mouth watering or burning, we can notice that these are simply physical sensations that are coming up, they're going away, they're coming up, they're going away, instead of some, you know, the moral imperative or overarching paradigm of, oh my gosh, if I don't smoke, my head will explode.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Dr. Judson Brewer about how we can break bad habits, how we can stop addictions, how we can defeat bad habits from smoking and drinking to mindless eating, stress eating, to even nail biting. Or what's your bad habit? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We have, Alan on Facebook says, I used to have a heroin and opiate habit, but I kicked it over a year ago. Wow, that's another really powerful one, too. I mean, will mindfulness work with a heroin addiction?
Yeah, it's a good question. So we're starting to pilot out the practices that we have in our clinic. So as I mentioned, we've got some clinical studies going on with our smoking program. And actually, if anybody's interested, we have an ongoing study. If they just go to the smokefree.gov website, they can find it amongst the other smoking cessation studies, and they can actually test out the apps that we've developed. We're now starting to test out a modified version of that in person, where I run a buprenorphine clinic here at UMass, where I treat patients with heroin and other opioid addictions using substitution medications such as buprenorphine, but importantly are starting to pair that with these behavioral treatments so they can learn the skills to be able to ride out their cravings. So absolutely, these techniques can be used for any type of habit or any type of addiction, and we're starting to work out the best ways to help people with that. You know, for example, there are these flipped classroom models that we're starting to test with our eating program, where we can give people an app where they can learn the didactics at home in short bite-sized pieces every day, where they get continuous training. And then they can come into our groups once a week, so they're taking their homework, which is their life, and bringing it to the group. And we can help support them and answer questions and make sure that they're able to go through the program properly in a group format.
Now, Nyjah Ellison, my producer, says that you have what is Claritas Mind Sciences?
Claritas Mind Sciences.
Okay.
So Claritas, the Latin for seeing clearly. Yale patented some of the work that I did when I was there, and spun off a startup company, because a lot of the work that gets done in academia doesn't actually make it out into the public. So Claritas has actually been the company that's developed these two apps. So one is Craving to Quit for their smoking cessation, and then the other one is Eat Right Now, as in eat correctly in the present moment. And that's for stress and emotional eating. And we're hoping to adapt those now with once we get a little more funding for general addiction, so we can help more broadly. So Claritas is kind of bringing the science that we've developed into the public.
Okay, Claritas. So what inspired you to turn to the digital market to help with this?
You know, it's a great question. I was finding in our in-person trials that several things. One is that it's really difficult for people to schedule their life around coming into a clinic, so that can be challenging for people. Another is that we don't learn to smoke or to stress eat in our therapist's office, so we're trying to unlearn context-dependent habits in a different context, which is suboptimal. And the third is that even though we were giving people simple practices, such as that RAIN acronym that I mentioned earlier, they would go home and they would forget to use them. And so I really wanted to find a way to deliver this training right to their fingertips in a way that maintained high fidelity, so they were getting good, accurate training. And the best way to do that was delivering it through a phone app. And then we can even pair that with in-person or online group support.
All right, then you're feeding my phone addiction, aren't you?
Well, in one sense, phones can be extremely powerful, and it's just like a knife. We can use that knife as a surgeon uses to help cure disease, and we can also use that to harm. And in the same way, our phones can be tremendously helpful. You know, my Google's map app is very, very helpful for me to get around the Boston area. Now, I think in the same way, we can harness this technology if we understand mechanistically what's happening. We can harness it in a way that can actually be helpful.
Well, yeah, I mean, I it sounds like I'm a real basket case here, but when I see that little red dot that says I've got a notification, I've got an email, or I've got a message, text message, or I've got a Facebook, you know, a comment, there's something going on that says check that.
Yeah, and so what does that feel like in your experience in that moment? What does that feel like in your body?
Yeah, I guess that's a good one. I guess it's probably someone has, you know, maybe there is a certain, I'm excited that someone has something to say to me. So I want to see what that is right now.
Yeah, and if you had to describe that experientially, would you say there's a level of urgency or restlessness that says, hey, do this?
Yep.
Yeah, so that level of, you know, even just the simple restlessness there is what urges us to act. And each time we act, it reinforces that behavior that says, oh, do that again. And that's where these simple practices of just paying attention, noticing what this feels like in our body, noticing that we don't have to compulsively act, gives us a tremendous amount of freedom to choose, oh, I can do this or not. And at first, it can be really difficult. It can feel really difficult because our brain is just, you know, urging us on. But as we learn that we can actually ride these out, we can develop a sense of ease and a sense of peace when we see that we're not slave to our habits.
Yeah. Do you think that that social media is addictive?
I think the social media is a perfect storm for this. So you can think of several things. One is just using Facebook as an example or Twitter. It's a medium for us to talk about ourselves and, you know, like what's on your mind. Oh, let me share what's on my mind with the world. That's actually been shown to activate to the nucleus accumbens, which is the part of the brain that gets activated by dopamine. So that may even tap into this very old process. So it's not necessarily our fault, but social media seems to be tapping into that aspect. It also taps into gossip, where we can see what other people are doing, which is also juicy, as well as providing us this intermittent reinforcement, as you described. You never know when you're going to get a new message or a new text or a new tweet. And so when this happens intermittently, this is the most reinforcing type of reward schedule. This is the same reward schedule that casinos use to get people to keep playing the slots.
Yeah, we have just a minute before a news break. In general, how long does it take to break a bad habit?
Well, some people get into this immediately, and they've quit smoking within a couple of weeks, and they even ask us. They say, "Can we keep using the app? Because I quit."
Yeah.
And I say, "Yes, of course." So some people just nail this right away because they just see so clearly what their habits are, and others take a bit longer.
Judson Brewer, Director of Research at the Center for Mindfulness and an Associate Professor in Medicine and Psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He is a psychiatrist and an addiction expert who researches mindfulness techniques that effectively put an end to cravings of all kind. We've also put on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page one of his TED Talks on breaking bad habits, simple ways to break bad habits. And we are talking about bad habits, how they form and how we can break them. And we are welcoming your questions. We're welcoming your bad habits that you would like some help defeating. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We'll check news and then we'll be back. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We continue our conversation about bad habits with Dr. Judson Brewer, who says mindfulness can help us break bad habits. And we're welcoming your questions for him and maybe your own suggestions. Our phones are a little bit quiet, and I'm guessing it's because most of you don't want to admit that you have any bad habits, right? Now, it doesn't have to be some sort of, you know, major addiction to heroin or something like that. It can be a bad habit that you would just like some advice, especially when it comes to how mindfulness might help you break a different bad habit. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So, why do you suppose it is bad habits are so hard to break? Or maybe you didn't have a hard time breaking your bad habit. Now, here's some bad habits that are not necessarily addictions to some sort of substance. Cheyenne on Facebook says, I have a bad habit of apologizing for everything. Now, we don't have a lot of details there, Dr. Brewer, but maybe talk a little bit about bad habits and our emotions.
Yeah, and even just using that as an example, I think that's a really good one where let's say that somebody, you know, we're in a tough situation with somebody or an argument. You know, what does it feel like when we're in the middle of an argument? It doesn't feel very good. So you can break it down. If you think of this habit loop, we're in a situation, it doesn't feel good. Our brain says, make this go away. This is really unpleasant. And so maybe we trip into apologizing and we say, you know, I'm sorry. And then that the argument goes away. And so there's a reward that comes with that, which is kind of a relief of being in that difficult situation, whether or not, and that was the most skillful thing to do in the moment for the argument, for us, for the other person. We don't, you know, I don't know the situation, but just using this as an example. So we can think of how, you know, if that's rewarding in another tough situation, which is stressful, our brain goes to its habits. It goes to what it knows. And so it says, oh, you know, last time you apologized and it, you know, and you felt better. So we just apologize, and that can become a habit in itself.
Yeah. So is there a mindfulness technique we can use to not apologize all the time? Or maybe that's not so bad. I don't know.
Well, yeah. I think, so if we look at apologies or if we look at anything like this, if it's just a temporary relief and it's not actually fixing the root cause of the problem, then it may just perpetuate it. So typically, you know, I can't speak one way or the or another, but I think this just shows how gray the areas can be and how we want to step back and look to see, you know, what is the root cause? And am I prematurely trying to end a conversation because it feels unpleasant, and instead step back, notice what that feels like in our body, just like the urge for a cigarette or a cookie, and see if we can just be with that. And that what that does is it gives our mind a little more breathing space to open up to really see, you know, what is the most skillful way to proceed here. And it may be, you know, engaging in the discussion, but perhaps in a slightly way that doesn't feel as defensive or feel like, you know, we have to be right or we have to prove a point or, you know, any nuance there.
Let's go to Elizabeth in Green Bay. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. So So I wanted to make a comment on how mindfulness is really great to use with your children. I just finished my master's in social work, and I learned about mindfulness in my coursework when my first daughter was 2 months, and my other one was 2 years old. So I started teaching them when they throw temper tantrums to take deep breaths, and where are you feeling stressed in your body, and what is it that you feel like? And now I get lots of comments from other parents, because apparently when their kids throw temper tantrums, my children come up and tell them to take deep breaths and think about it, and it calms down other people's kids. So, I mean, it's a great tool for us as adults to, you know, end bad habits, but it's also really good to use with young children to teach them how to be able to control their emotions at a really young age.
I love that. Dr. Brewer?
Yeah, that's great, and I think we can also teach our inner children when we're having a tantrum to be able to, you know, stop and calm down as well, so that we can not only teach our children but model this behavior for our children as well, and I'm sure you're doing that already.
Yeah, that I think that's a great example, little kids telling other little kids to, you know, take a deep breath. and my husband is a yoga teacher, and when I'm yelling about something, that he will often just say, you know, just breathe. And what about, maybe talk a little bit about if our bad habit is that we have a short fuse, what's a good mindfulness technique for that?
Well, the nice thing about this is these practices work in the same way. So it's not like, oh, if I'm angry, I have to do this, and I'm stressed, I have to do this. If X, anything that's causing kind of a mental or a physical contraction, we can get curious. Oh, what does this feel like in my body? So if I'm starting to, you know, if we have a short fuse and I'm starting to get angry, I can just stop, if I can, in that moment, stop and notice what that feels like, to just feel that heat and the energy and all of that, which can give me that space to notice, oh, I'm getting caught up in this, and also gives me the space to reflect on, oh, what happened when I got, you know, I blew up last time, that wasn't that helpful. So I just like, oh, what happened when I smoked last time or ate the cookie last time, which also builds that disenchantment. So in the moment, if we can stop and, you know, like the caller was saying, take a deep breath, pay attention to what our body feels like. And even if we can't do that and we, you know, we lash out, we can still stop immediately afterwards and reflect on it honestly with ourselves and say, what did I get from that? You know, like, what did that feel like in my body? What were the consequences? So that we can see clearly what that reward actually was, which is typically just like smoking or stress eating, not as great as our brain made it out to be.
Mm-hmm. Cy in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I had a question. I have a bad habit of biting my lip.
Yes.
Or the inside of my jaw.
Well, and we're having a hard time hearing what you're saying, Cy, because of the background noise, but I guess he wants to know, why does he bite his nails?
Yes. So nail biting is another great example of a habit that can get formed early in life. You know, I started biting my nails, I don't know when, and it was related to stress. And so we can, you know, if you bite your nails, you can stop anytime you bite your nails in the moment that your finger's in your mouth, and you can stop and notice what it's like and what you get from biting your nails, if there's a compulsion to do it. And then in that moment, notice, just drop your awareness into your body and notice what that urge to bite your nails feels like, and see if you can just get curious about it and just play with those sensations as you consciously pull your fingers out of your mouth. And then the next time an urge to bite your nails comes up, you can get really curious. Oh, what does this urge feel like in my body? Bringing that curiosity to the moment, and in essence, riding out that wave of urgency to bite your nails.
You know, we had a caller who, I guess, didn't want to stay, but said that she smokes marijuana, and she wonders if it's easy to break what she calls a social habit. Maybe talk some about how our bad habits come from peer pressure or social constructs.
Yeah, so social constructs play a big role here. So, for example, with our eating program, we've had people commenting on our online community that they can eat mindfully when they're alone, but they have real difficulty eating mindfully when they're with family or friends because of, you know, the whole ritual around eating. So it can be more difficult, especially if we're engaged in conversation with people, if we're in the middle of things, or if we're expected, whether it's smoking or, you know, our mom saying, you know, you're not eating my food, you don't love me.
you know?
So we can, in those moments, even then we can stop and notice that urge and even just, you know, play with you kind of put it out there and say, hey, look, you know, I'm trying to actually pay attention as I'm eating, or, you know, I'm trying not to smoke so much marijuana or whatever. So I'm happy to be here engaged with y'all, but I'm just going to play with riding this craving out so that we can, in those moments, just kind of name what we're doing so it doesn't seem like we're withdrawing from folks, and at the same time start to play with noticing all of the pieces that contribute to these habits, including our social situations.
Michelle in Racine is with us. Hello, Michelle.
Hi. I just wanted to ask you, throughout my whole life, I've stayed at a healthy weight, and then 5 or 6 years ago, I put on a bunch of weight because I lost my job, my parents got ill, and so I think I was using food to, you know, make
comfort
myself
yourself,
feel better
yeah.
or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so since October, I've lost 25 pounds and I feel real good, but I'm still eating a lot of like fruits and vegetables, and they're all very healthy foods.
Mm-hmm.
But I still, when I get home from work, I just eat until I feel really full, and I don't want to do that.
Yeah, and Michelle, I'm glad you called, but we have just a minute or so to go, Dr. Brewer. What can you tell Michelle?
Well, briefly, I would say you can play. That's exactly the programs that we've developed to help people with these habits, and it can be the same habit whether we're eating junk food or eating healthy food. If we're eating to, you know, in a way that you're describing. So the briefest thing I would say is you can play with our app called Eat Right Now, which gives the tools to work with that.
Yeah. In our final minute, if someone wants to put an end to a bad habit today, what's the first step?
The first step is to pay attention to see what the actual rewards are that we get from our habits, you know, and to see what we're getting when we're smoking or when we're eating that fourth cookie. And then the next step is to, you know, to learn some practices so that we can really see clearly what those cravings feel like so we can ride them out, as we talked about.
I'm not going to have a candy bar after I get off the air. Thank you very much for being with us.
This is my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Judson Brewer, Director of Research at the Center for Mindfulness and an Associate Professor in Medicine and Psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. Thanks to Nyasia Ellison and to Brianne Chasso for producing this program. Thank you for listening. We'll put more information about Dr. Brewer's program on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I hope you join us tomorrow at this time. We are going to talk about dyslexia. That's tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.